Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by San Francisco State University's graduate business programs offering 5 accredited advanced degrees, the SF State MBA, rigorous, real-world, respected, open house schedule, and more information at mba.sfsu.edu.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, sitting in this week for Michael Krasny. In this hour, setting new standards for great coffee. San Francisco has a long history in the coffee business, going all the way back to the Gold Rush. Today, a new generation of coffee innovators is moving away from the dark roast coffee pioneered by companies like Peet's and towards subtler blends, an emphasis on building relationships with coffee bean farmers around the world. This hour, we'll talk with some of those coffee entrepreneurs from Blue Bottle, Four Barrel, and Ritual Coffee Companies. And we'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome once again to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here this week for Michael Krasny. And this hour, we're all about coffee. We've come a long way from the time that coffee was basically a caffeine delivery mechanism, and as we all know, a segment of the Bay Area coffee business is becoming almost as complex and sophisticated as the wine industry, if not more so in some ways. And joining us this hour, some of the innovators whose coffees you've no doubt heard of, tasted, and maybe even waited in line for at cafes and farmers markets throughout the region. Eileen Hasse is the owner of Ritual Coffee Roasters on Valencia Street in San Francisco. Welcome. Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
Also here, James Freeman, who's the owner of Blue Bottle Coffee, based in Oakland. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And with us as well, Jeremy Tooker, who is it Tooker or Tooker?
Tooker.
Tooker, who owns Four Barrel, also on Valencia Street, at the other end of the street there in San Francisco. Let me begin with you, James Freeman. Give us your take. What's the state of the coffee business right now, and how does it differ from where we were, you know, 3, 5, 10 years ago in San Francisco? What's changing?
Well, I think people are recognizing when something's prepared well and with craft and interest, and there's a lot more demand for something that's a coffee that's roasted well, sourced well, and prepared well in an interesting space by, you know, nice people. I think there's fewer cafes that don't take into account the quality of the coffee they're making, whereas, you know, I started 9 years ago. And there's sort of this genre of San Francisco cafes where exactly what the coffee tasted like might not be the most important thing.
But it was more about the ambiance and
Yeah. So I think it's fantastic. There's an astonishing consumer demand for good coffee, and we're benefiting from it. Our wholesale accounts are benefiting from it.
So, Eileen Hasse, what would you add to that, and what do you think accounts for it? Is it just you know, people sort of looking for a better and better quality or a different taste than maybe they've become accustomed to?
Well, I think there's something really special happening in the Bay Area right now. I would go so far as to say that San Francisco has better coffee than any other city in the world.
Wow.
The only city—
Even Oakland? I mean—
Well, I'm sorry.
That's where Blue Bottle is.
No, I mean—
You mean the Bay Area.
Right, but I mean the Bay Area. And James obviously has more than one location in San Francisco, so he's definitely has a strong presence in the city of San Francisco. But, you know, the only city that might give San Francisco a run for its money is Oslo.
Oslo, Norway.
Oslo.
Really?
Yep.
Oslo's awesome.
What is it about Oslo, and what happened to Italy, anyway?
I think— to be fair, I went to Italy back in 2007. My star barista and I were flown there to make coffee at a conference there.
Your star barista. We'll come back to that in a minute, but go ahead.
And I was really disappointed, to be fair. I think that the culture in Italy, you know, they're, of course, responsible for espresso and the history of, you know, a great deal of the history of the coffee industry. But I think they've stopped. And I think that it's a very... You know, I actually came back being very proud to be an American in a way, which was a new
Unlike
feeling
how you left,
to me. Well, I mean, I just, it made me realize that innovation is something that we take for granted here and that you're always trying to push forward and you're always trying to do something new. And in Italy, and, you know, there were many people from other European countries there who had had coffee businesses, you know, since coffee was traded as a commodity with flour and grain. And these people, you know, had great family businesses going back hundreds of years, but they didn't see any need to figure out anything new.
Yeah. And Jeremy, you agree with that? And have you been to Oslo as well?
Actually, no. I forfeited my trip a couple months ago, but no.
Yeah.
But I have a lot of friends there that have shops. And I know that their taste in coffee is very good. They're classically trained in cupping, and they're also innovative in their own right. So
yeah, and you know, it seems like, I don't know, was it the 90s when sort of dark roast became the way to go, and people were looking for that espresso kind of flavor? Is that not the case, or is it you're diversifying really more toward medium roasts, not just you folks, but Pete's and others?
Yeah, well, I guess that lately I've been describing our roasts. Roast level is sort of a blunt instrument in describing how we roast coffee. It's for us, it's like how we develop the coffee to get to that point. There's a lot of roast curves and looking at the coffee and smelling the coffee. But yeah, I guess if you looked at our coffee and you just, you know, as a consumer, you say it was like a medium roast. Full development is important for us, but a good keeping the acidity there and highlighting the body and the sweetness as well.
Yeah, and also relationships, James, with the growers, with the coffee bean growers. Is that part of what you're doing and developing those relationships?
Yeah, I think that's an important part of what we're doing. Our green coffee buyers might be in Panama now. He's leaving soon, and he's got trips to plan to Honduras and El Salvador. And the more interest people have in very special single origins, the more important it is to have direct relationships with people doing interesting things at the farm level. If I could just put in a word in defense of Italian coffee traditions, however, I think what's impressive about Italy is they've created this system, this kind of industrialized system of near universal adequacy. And that's very rare, you know, to be able to walk into almost any place in Italy and get something that's not terrible, I think is very special and impressive. And they do it at a very largely sort of industrialized, mechanized scale.
How do they do that?
Huge roasters. Well, there's a culture of demand. There's, you know, certain, you know, you get an espresso, just an Ely espresso in any random bar in Rome, and it's going to be have like a 25-second extraction. The machine isn't going to be super dirty. It's going to be like a good 3/4 ounce single. And that's very rare. So I do agree with Eileen in that sort of the pushing of boundaries is not really tolerated or expected in Italy, but it's kind of nice to see like old ladies put down their shopping bags and order an espresso.
Yeah, you know? I absolutely agree with James. That is a very good description. And I would actually start to put, I think Seattle is becoming I would put Seattle in that category too. Where
I've heard sort of the coffee, Seattle has kind of stagnated a bit.
Well, that's what I mean. It's like there's more, you know, adequate coffee
broadly
I think
available.
That was a good
coffee
description. You know, the place I lived there, and there was a place that rotated your tires, and they would make you an espresso while you waited, and it was adequate. But here, you know, adequate isn't good enough.
Yeah,
anymore.
I actually had espresso at a truck stop in Italy, which
right
was really fun. The truckers coming up and getting little shots of espresso. We're going to open the phone lines early this morning because I think a lot of people have things to say and questions to ask about coffee, a lot of opinions maybe. 866-733-6786 is the number, 866-733-6786, or you can email your comments and questions to forum@kqed.org. Our guests this hour, three of the top coffee entrepreneurs here in the Bay Area, Eileen Hasse from Ritual Coffee Roasters in San Francisco, James Freeman, owner of Blue Bottle Coffee, and Jeremy Tooker, owner of Four Barrel Coffee, also on Valencia Street. How much of it, Eileen, would you say is the beans? How much of it is the machinery that's used? And how much of it is the barista, the technique that they use? How do you divide that
well
up?
The unfortunate thing is all of those matter. You know, I gave a talk once, and I tried to condense it to 5 minutes about how you should do a dance of joy every time you get a good cup of coffee, because so many factors have to line up for the end product to be good. But I mean, the beans themselves have so much to do with it, because you can't you can't improve upon what's there, really. You can, in the roasting, you can bring out what's there, you know, the natural characteristics that are there because of where it was grown, what varietal it is, how it was processed. But of course, you know, even if you have an amazing, you know, coffee from an amazing farm that was roasted well, if you're not preparing it well, then
you're gonna
those flavors aren't going to come out.
You're not going to make the premium coffee. Jeremy, what would you add to that? And how do you train the baristas to, you know, to make sure that they're not the weak link in the chain?
We have a very special integrator program where they start off training. We have a little training area in the back room. First and foremost, they get a lot of training on Coffee 101, like the history of coffee and how coffee is processed, so they can get excited about it and translate that to the customers. And then they go into the customer service training, which is, we took 4 months to write a 10-page customer service manifesto. It's very important.
Manifesto?
Yeah.
Okay. And yeah. What are some of the highlights of that?
Well, it basically describes like what it means to provide good customer service, how gracious we should be that the customers are coming in and paying for coffee, it's very involved.
And James, what would you add to the training aspect of the baristas?
Well, to agree with Jeremy that's a critical part, because our customers don't get served by me or Eileen or Jeremy. They get served by our employees, and the more we can invest in their training and their education, the better they're going to be able to represent this product. We've got a training department and sort of the luxury of space in Oakland. We have a training room, and you know, there's sort of this curriculum that our trainers have worked out to teach our baristas. And
so, how often does a barista come in and just not cut it?
The nice thing about coffee is it's teachable. You know, my last career, there's basically a 12-year-long apprenticeship before you even know if you're going to be able to make a living or not. And if somebody...
What was your last career?
Oh, I used to be a clarinet player.
Oh, wow.
So, I like coffee a lot better. the nice thing is if somebody's sort of reasonably bright and interested and passionate, they can be great in 6 months.
Yeah,
and I love that about coffee.
Yeah. 866-733-6786, the number to call if you want to chat about coffee this morning. And our first call, let's go to, El Dorado Hills in California. Or, I'm sorry, Mark in Pacifica. Sorry, Mark. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I was telling your screener that I had recently been to southern India and had coffee there that was excellent. And I'm finding it hard to find places in the Bay Area that carry Indian-grown coffee, and I'm wondering if your guests knew where I could look for that.
Hmm. James, you're making a scrunched-up nose
face. Oh, I just always make a scrunched-up nose face, sorry.
Anybody know of Indian farmers?
Actually, the only place that I know of in the Bay Area that's, that has Indian-grown coffee would be Sweet Maria's, and you'd have to roast it yourself.
Yeah.
So he provides green coffee to home roasters.
Another Oakland business. I think India is very much an up-and-coming destination or appellation for roasting. We've been talking to a couple Indian farmers and have some samples. We're waiting for their organic certification to come through. So I think it's interesting that this gentleman brought up India, because I think you'll hear more and more about Indian coffee.
Yeah. Let's read some email. Zach writes, I'm an independent coffee roaster on the North Sonoma coast. I buy in bulk exclusively from Sweet Maria's in Oakland and roast with a Sono Fresco roaster. The most consistent market value is a fresh roast that will last for a week on the counter in a glass jar. I encourage all my clients to maintain this level of freshness. The niche markets serve this ability to provide people with a roast that won't go stale and provide better and better flavor for the duration. Also, let's see, an email from Oakland. I must say that I resent the coffee 3.0 snobs who refuse to prepare coffee the way you want it and turn a good cup into a snobby ordeal and one-uppery. I also resent you telling me I can't have a double espresso and or iced espresso. That's Jason in Oakland. Are we sort of taking this to a level that's a little bit, beyond what is called for, given that it's just coffee beans? Eileen?
Coffee is so complex. I've been in coffee for 10 years, and the more I learn, the more I realize I have more to learn. It makes me sad to hear, that somebody's feeling like that, were guilty of snobbery. That's definitely never my intention with ritual, certainly, because, you know, we love coffee and we want to share it with other people who love it. I think, you know, when somebody comes in and tells us what recipe they want their coffee to be brewed at, it undermines all of the training that we're talking about. You know, James is saying, you know, somebody who came in with a love of coffee, but not necessarily any experience, can put 6 months into it and become a good barista, you know, and to for that training, you know, they're getting to know the coffees, they're getting to taste them and putting all of our experience into what we think tastes good. And that's what we want to be sharing with the customers. Like, but here's where we think the coffee tastes the best.
And Jeremy, as part of that four-barrel manifesto mm-hmm. in dealing with the customers, mm-hmm. What if a customer comes in? I mean, Starbucks is sort of famous or infamous for, you know, you tell them exactly what you want and they'll give it to you. What if a customer like Jason there comes in and says, I want something iced, or I want it this way or that way? How are your baristas trained to deal with that?
Well, my baristas are actually pretty lucky in terms of we don't have it in house, we don't have an ingredient in house, we can't make it like a non-fat latte. We don't use non-fat milk.
Why?
It's more of a matter of taste for me. Like, I just didn't want to serve. I wanted to give my baristas something, drinks that they could stand behind and would drink themselves.
So if a customer, you know, can't have fat or doesn't want fat,
we suggest Americanos, which is espresso and water. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And what kind of, you ever get anybody that says, just was sort of insistent or even belligerent about it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we get it all the time, but I think our customers, our regular base has learned like the protocol and how to order coffee at Four Barrel, and they're interested in, our policy is like we have ice and we have espresso. So will we make an iced espresso? Yes, we will.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, exactly. James, anything to add to that? Is there a concern that you're, you know, I mean, a lot of people look at the wine industry and say, you know, people say, oh, they taste it, and they say they taste hints of vanilla and apricot and, you know, almond or whatever. But, you know, to what extent can the average person really taste the difference between, you know, good coffee and excellent coffee, say?
I think it's pretty easy. I mean, that's why all of our shops are busier every year. We have public cuppings at our roastery in Oakland twice a week, and people are thrilled that come in. They're free, and people are thrilled that it's easy to tell the difference between these four regions of coffee, and they have something to connect with. We don't sort of manufacture adjectives to give to them. We try to elicit their responses, but quite often they're fairly consistent. We all made our businesses based on not trying to be everything for everybody. You know, there's a very successful business, much more successful than I'll ever be, called Starbucks, that's great at getting people exactly what they want. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, we regretfully kind of have to say, sorry, we can't do that for various reasons. We try to be nice about it. And some people are understanding. Some people think it's great. And every once in a while, either we have a customer service failure or there's just somebody we can't connect with.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. Todd is on the line in Menlo Park. Good morning.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
Love your program, and really glad to hear you talking about coffee. I'm a bit of a wine snob and a coffee snob, but I've heard a couple of your guests mention Sweet Maria's. I want to put in a plug from being a home roaster. I'm an accidental home roaster. Got turned on to some Yemeni coffee through Blue Bottle. And it's a little hard to find sometimes, and I went trolling through the internet and found some that seemed half priced, and I bought it and arrived, and it was green beans, and I had no idea what to do with it, and started searching the internet and found Sweet Maria's, which has a great website on how to do your own home roasting, and I've become an absolute addict with nothing more than a hot air popcorn popper and my stovetop Bialetti, and I just have a blast.
That sounds like fun. James, to what extent, are there other places in the Bay Area that, people can just bring, to do their own roasting? I mean, are we going in that direction at all, do you think?
I think it's always going to be sort of the geeky lunatic fringe that is really, and I say that without any malice because I started as a home roaster, so that's how I got my start. And I think it's hard enough and inconvenient enough that a certain subset of people are going to be thrilled to be roasting their coffee at home, and Sweet Maria's as an Oakland business is awesome, and they're great at coffee, and catering to that. I think coffee is social, basically. So they're, even if people have a great espresso machine at home and roast their own coffee at home, oftentimes they want to go to our shops and order an espresso and tell our baristas all about it.
That brings up an interesting question, because at Ritual on Valencia Street, you go in there and a lot of people are on their laptops. They have their earbuds in. They're working. I mean, I think for some people it's their office. Mm-hmm. And then Four Barrel, and they have Wi-Fi as well. And now Four Barrel, I don't think you have Wi-Fi, right?
No, we don't.
So why did you decide not to make it that that kind of a environment?
I mean, that was sort of something that when Eileen and I opened Ritual together, it was a decision that we made that I think I personally regretted, just because I thought, I wanted to open a cafe for that social environment. And immediately we saw the influx of laptops and office dwellers. And, when the music stopped, you could literally hear a pin drop. So, and it was...
No
one was talking to each other. I think and it's one of those things you can't really take back once you've initiated it.
Because people expect it.
Yeah.
So. What do you think about that, Eileen? Any regrets or?
No, I mean.
Some cafes will say you can't, be working at a table or using a laptop during lunch or something.
Right. Well, we don't.
You don't really have a
we
lunch
don't have
business.
Lunch. Yeah. So lunch is actually a great time to come in and set up your laptop because it's pretty quiet. I like the inclusiveness of it. I like, there are other decisions that I've made that are also inclusive. Like I serve tea and I serve, things that aren't coffee. And to me, that's a part of the experience of being in a cafe. I know when I'm traveling, I rely on cafes to get some of my work done and things like that. So.
And James, Uke's Blue Bottle has kind of a hybrid. I mean, you have some places like at the Ferry Building where people just walk in and walk away after about a 20-minute wait, because there's a lot of people wanting coffee there. But then
shop.
You have a couple of cafes. You also have a mobile truck that sells.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
What are your thoughts about that? Because, coffee is kind of a place, cafes is a place for community.
Yeah, I don't usually use that word. I just like talking instead of community. But yeah, none of our shops have Wi-Fi except for the shop we have in the Museum of Modern Art and the Sculpture Garden, and that's because the museum has Wi-Fi. I like the idea of small, sort of congested, boisterous, fun places where people, order a drink and drink it in a few minutes, and then off they go to their next thing. So a lot of our shops are like that. The shop we have at Mint is a little more relaxed.
Mint Alley.
Yeah, but still no computers. You can do a lot. I thought about just sort of the design in general. We don't have two tops or four tops in any of our shops, just because I like the idea of communal seating. And I've seen so many people just like strike up conversations next to people in line. I've seen marriages and kids result in that.
Really? Marriages?
Yeah.
Proposals?
Yes. Proposals, kids.
Over a cappuccino.
That. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm surprised. You're very low-key and soft-spoken, which is not what I would expect. And as are you, Jeremy. Eileen, you're a little more animated. But
I was shouting a lot this morning.
You're shouting. Yeah. How much coffee have you had this morning?
A lot, yeah.
You've had a lot?
So
you're
much,
just, you just throttle down deliberately to...
Yeah, yeah. No, I think all of us, we drink a lot of coffee, but... it doesn't
define you.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we have a lot more to talk about, and we want to hear from you, our listeners, as well. All about coffee this hour. 866-733-6786 is the number to call, and our guests will be with us for the rest of the hour. Eileen Hasse from Ritual, James Freeman from Blue Bottle, and Jeremy Tooker from Four Barrel Coffee on Valencia Street. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Give us a call or send us your thoughts, comments at forum@kqed.org as well. Stay with us. And we continue our conversation about coffee this hour on Forum. Our guests, Eileen Hasse, owner of Ritual Coffee Roasters, James Freeman from Blue Bottle, and Jeremy Tooker, rather, from Four Barrel Coffee, also on Valencia Street. The number to call, 866-733-6786. Let's start with Scott in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hey there. How you doing today?
Good, thanks.
Good. Just like to start off by thanking the three guests for bringing coffee to the level they have in the city as a coffee lover. I appreciate all of their places that I've been to. One other thing I like to mention is foam. I'm somewhat of a foamasaur, where I really appreciate the foam artwork and consistencies, and like to see, you know, more attention paid to that as well as to the, you know, the coffee flavors. But yeah, the foam is really taking me
like
to
that.
A new level of coffee appreciation.
Don't you feel guilty about like ruining it by sipping it?
Ruin the foam? Well, actually, I take pictures of it.
You take pictures of it.
And then I sip it. So I've got quite a collection. And, you know, I like the fact that all three of these places, Ritual, Fort Barrel, and Blue Bottle, are very distinctively different. You know, I like to go into Valencia, the Ritual, when I want to sit down and do something on the computer. But I like the energy of Fort Barrel if I'm just sort of standing around chatting with friends. And then Blue Bottle with its, you know, many locations and all of their quality. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having them.
Yeah, thanks, Sagat, for the call.
Thanks.
What about the foam? How do you
actually? That was one of my aha moments in coffee. When I first moved to Seattle, I went out and had a cappuccino, and I was blown away. It was the first time I had milk that was properly steamed, and I went up to the barista and I said, "What is this? Like, what milk did you use? Do you put sugar in the milk?" And he just started laughing because he had obviously gotten that question a million times before. And then I asked for a job because I wanted to learn how to make that milk steam like that. And really, I mean, what I was tasting is that when you steam milk properly, what you're doing is you're caramelizing the sugars in there. So you actually are creating
a sweeter taste.
And, of course, that goes very nicely with the espresso.
Yeah. And Jeremy, what do you tell the baristas about, you know, the foam art?
Well, it's just one of those things. It's a flourish on the drink. It is necessary as part of our training to learn how to do that, so you can make drinks competently. But what it really does is makes the baristas pay attention, closer attention to everything. You know, if it's not properly steamed, you can't make the, you know, the little rosetta or the heart. So that's one of the things. I just want to throw in, I got let go from Starbucks when I was 19 because I refused to stop making latte art on drinks.
Oh, really?
So.
Well, now you're competing with them.
Yeah.
Here's an email from Bob who writes, I was wondering if the caffeine content of espresso is higher than a normal cup of coffee. James, I've always heard it's actually a little lower, but...
Well, I mean, it depends
on
what
quantity.
You mean by a normal cup of coffee. I think people, espresso is usually consumed in, 90 seconds? So people feel the effects of all the caffeine in a serving of espresso much faster than a brewed coffee that's, you know, drunk over perhaps 20 minutes. So I think that's why people feel the espresso more.
There's also no milk to kind of slow the absorption, probably.
Yes. But just in terms of consumption, I think there's much more in sort of a standard pour over, there's much more caffeine in a, you know, a 10-ounce pour over than there is in espresso, but, you know, it's spread out over a longer period of time.
Yeah. Another email here from Robert in San Jose who writes, I just returned from a vacation in Spain, a country which probably has more bars per capita than any other. Walk into just almost any bar in any part of Spain, Italy, or France, and you get a great cup of coffee. So why in the U.S. does it take all this barista training, secret handshake stuff, and a lot of cash to get a great cup of coffee? Eileen?
I attribute it to culture. This is something that's relatively new in American culture, and so it's not everywhere. But I think you're becoming, you know, it's starting to be more and more ubiquitous, and people do have higher and higher standards for their coffee.
And for a lot of people in a lot of places, I mean, my family is in Buffalo. Starbucks is better than what they've had for a long time.
Right.
So it really is relative to what you've had before.
Right.
You know, whatever the next level is.
And I'd love to put in a plug for San Francisco is home to the Irish coffee. There's now a bar where you can get an Irish coffee made with good coffee. And that's Dear Mom. Not far from here.
Where is that? I don't know.
At 16th and Harrison.
16th and Harrison. Okay. Here's another email from Tim in Berkeley. Berkeley's Cafe Mediterranean on Telegraph says it's the originator of lattes. True? Anybody? James?
Well, a guy that used to work for me now has a coffee bar in New York. It's called Abrasso. It's a really good place. He is maybe not the most reliable narrator, but he worked at Cafe Mediterranean when they had a six group San Marco lever. And he would tell me stories of the old days at Café Med. And, you know, whether it's apocryphal or inaccurate or truthful, a lot of people are saying that that's where the latte came because the cappuccinos were too strong. And people would ask for more milk on top of their cappuccinos. And the owner would say, latte, latte, which meant more milk on top of the cappuccino, hence the...
Yeah, and they don't really have those in Europe or in Italy?
Well, you say the word latte in an Italian coffee bar, you'll get a glass of milk because that's...
Well, and you also get something like a cortado, right? Mm-hmm. Or I think it, for, at Blue Bottle, you call it a Gibraltar.
Yeah.
Which is a short, like
it's
a short... It's a long story.
Yeah.
I love Gibraltar.
Yeah, it's a lovely drink, and it's very much like a...
You're like in a shot glass,
a
right?
Cortado. We had a barista at our kiosk, one of the opening baristas, who now is Eileen's employee. I was about to say, now he's your problem, Eileen. No, I take that back, Steve. but we bought these cups, these 4.5-ounce cups, because we thought we were going to do some cupping out of them, but then they were too small. So we were testing the espresso out of our little garage kiosk before we opened. And, you know, then the women from the corset shop would come over and were curious, and we would give them, you know, an espresso and it's too strong, you know, so we'd have some milk and all we had were these little glasses. And, it's the Libby company makes the glasses, and somebody at some point said, oh, well, what do you call that drink in those glasses? And the name of the glasses are Gibraltar. So this guy said, oh, that's our Gibraltar, you know, ha, ha, ha.
And so that's...
And the name stuck.
It stuck, yeah. And in fact, I have to put in a plug for our favorite cafe right here in the neighborhood near KQED, Coffee Bar, which is on Florida in Mariposa.
Right.
I go in and order a triple Gibraltar. Uh-huh. But how is it different from a Cortado?
Maybe it's not different at all. Maybe it's different in the minds of some of the people who are drinking it. Basically, it's a not super hot 4.5-ounce milk drink. The milk is steamed sort of more like thinly and elegantly as if it were a latte. It's meant to be consumed in a fairly short amount of time. You know, we can't take any credit for inventing such a drink like that, but I think we did sort of demonstrate the unarticulated desire for a drink like that. And you know, since it's been odd to see it popping up in Japan and London and Los Angeles and stuff like that.
I want to ask you about, during the break, we were talking about making coffee at home, which is what, you know, most folks do. I was saying that, you know, I use one of these French press, and I use beans from Pete's usually, and I grind them at home, and the flavor is just kind of inconsistent. What tips do you have?
You brought some ritual coffee beans.
Okay.
Make some coffee with some ritual
beans. But what am I doing wrong other than not using your beans?
Well, you mentioned that you have a grinder that's the kind of whirly blade grinder.
Yeah, I've had it for 20-something years.
That is the source of the majority of
that's
your problems,
the weak link.
I would expect. Because
maybe a hammer would be more accurate.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
The problem is that the way that – it's basically chopping the beans. So you get some parts of the beans that are ground very, very fine. And then you get others that are still visibly a coffee bean, maybe a third of a coffee bean in some cases.
But what if you like grind it into sort of a powder? You just do it long enough.
You're still getting – even though it all, to your eye, looks – fine, you're still getting a huge range. And the problem is that the finest particles are going to extract very quickly, meaning the flavor is going to leave the coffee, you know,
go
into the water. And the coarser particles are not going to extract fully. Basically, I mean, I'll keep this short, because I could talk about the science of coffee for a long time. But basically, 26% of coffee is water-soluble. So you can get 26% of the bean into the water. You don't want all 26%. You want somewhere between 18 and 22%.
So
when you get that really fine, you're going to get all 26%. And the coarser side of the beans, you're going to get less than 18%.
So what's a better grinder?
So you need a burr grinder.
Besides a hammer.
Which basically means that there's a plate and there's teeth that the coffee has to pass through. And so you get a really even consistency. And so your coffee is going to extract evenly.
Now how much do those cost?
I mean, the one that everybody in the coffee industry recommends, I don't know if anybody else has a different recommendation. I recommend the Baratza. And they're, you know, if you're just doing French press, you can get away with their lowest end grinder, which retails for about $130.
Wow.
But, there, it's a, you know, that company, if there's any problems with the grinder, you send it back and they'll just send you a new one.
I've had my Krups for 23 years.
Right, but you're articulating this dissatisfaction with your coffee.
But sometimes,
you know,
it's
can good. You put a... Right. But what if you could, you know, organize your variables such that every morning was good?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that, I mean, can you put a price on that? Is $1.30 a small price?
I find that whipping cream, it really covers up a lot of inconsistencies. So.
Fattest flavor.
Jeremy, did you want to add anything to that?
Well, there's actually, we use a hand grinder when we travel, and it's, if you have strong forearms and some patience, it's it looks like a pepper mill, basically, and that's what it is.
Yeah, and what about buying ground beans? No, James is shaking his head. Why not?
Because, I mean, what do you have? You've got an hour, 40 minutes.
Then what happens?
Then they don't taste as good. I mean, we take some heat because we try very nicely to say we won't grind coffee for customers. We only sell whole bean customers just because we can't in good conscience sell somebody a product we know is going to be not very delicious in a very short period of time.
Hmm. And what about whole beans? You keep them in the fridge, in the freezer, where?
No, in your cupboard.
Just keep it in a kind of a moderate temperature.
Yeah.
Okay. And then what about the type of coffee makers at home? Any, like, what's a good, what would you say, what would you recommend for people? You know, they don't want to buy a $1,200 espresso maker.
Right. I mean, a couple of years ago, we switched to brewing using the Hario V60, which is a cone that brews one cup at a time. And part of the reason that we switched to that is just to demonstrate that you can make a really great cup of coffee with a very inexpensive investment. You know, the cone is $25, and then you'll need to buy, you know, a $3 pack of filters every couple of months, but that's about it.
Do they still make those old Chemex kind that with one filter on top?
Yeah.
And is that similar, would you say?
It's similar. I'm not a fan of the Chemex filter, and I think that it doesn't do as nice a job of extracting because you've got – it's a very crude filter because it's just a square piece of paper that's folded. And so you get three ply on one side and one on the other, and that's just – that's really going to –
not going to work.
Ruin your
anything experience. To add to tips for homemakers?
I think simple is better. You know, we like a Bon Mac cone, but you know, just a little ceramic or plastic cone, some filters, a good grinder, gram scale.
Gram scale too.
Yeah.
For the amount.
Yeah. To weigh your coffee and the water.
Yeah, the water. Yeah.
And what about the temperature of the water?
That's
James.
It should be. I mean, repeatable. If you have a candy thermometer or a thermocouple or something like that, it's should not be boiling. And depending on sort of the coffee you're making and the style that you wish to make, anywhere between, you know, 83 degrees centigrade and 94 degrees centigrade, I think is.
And so what I do is, because I'm getting ready in the morning, the water boils, I throw it on, you know, over the grounds. Because I hear I'm not supposed to do that. But how long should I let it sit? I mean, before it gets to the right temperature?
It depends on how dense your kettle is, you know, obviously.
Oh, no. How am I going to figure that out?
Well, just leave it on the counter, you know, to take it off the boil. Put it on the counter, leave it there for 45 seconds.
45 seconds.
And if it's palpably more delicious that morning, then you know you've achieved something.
Okay.
One thing I'll add, too, is that we recently did a test. We bought a bunch of home brewers. I mean, just, you know, automatic drip brewers. And it turned out that the average temperature we were getting was about 150 degrees. and a lot of the way a lot of them work is they'll heat the water, and as soon as the water is starting to boil, it'll start trickling out. So basically at the beginning of the extraction, you have water that's not hot enough. And at the end, you have water that's too hot. And so right in that middle, you're going to get that sweet spot. But other than that, you're not.
And the sweet spot would be, what would you say, temperature-wise?
So in Fahrenheit, I'd say like around 203.
203. Okay.
And there is one company that makes a brewer that actually gets to the right temperature, and that's a Technoform.
How much do those cost?
They're $250 retail.
Yeah.
But...
Okay.
But you don't need it. You need $20.
Right.
You don't need anything with a plug.
Yeah. Just a cone and a filter. Yeah. And what about French press?
I think, you know, the vicissitudes of fashion have made the French press maybe less popular with some of the coffee bars that are opening up. I think it's kind of designed to pair well with condiments. So, you know, because it's a little bit gritty and it's thick. right? There's a lot of body, and if you put half and half or whipping cream in your case, Scott, in your coffee,
more fat, the better.
That can kind of titrate out those little particles, and it'll be smoother if you add milk. Whereas pour over coffee is very smooth, and if you add milk, sometimes you kind of leach the elegance out of it. So I think people should think about, you know, if they're married to, you know, heavy cream, French press could be the best option for them, whereas pour over might seem a little faint.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go back to the phones now. Diane is on the line in Sebastopol. Good morning.
Good morning. When I was in college in Florida, I worked in cheap and cheerful breakfast places as a waitress. And the big criterion for delicious coffee, and it was delicious, it wasn't strong, but it was delicious, was that it have globs of grease floating on top of it. We made it in a drip, you know, one of those bun drip makers, big stainless steel thing, with a filter. And I have not seen those globs of grease on my coffee lately. What were they, and where did they go?
It wasn't bacon grease, was it?
No. Oh, no, it was from the coffee.
From the coffee, okay.
Any made a difference. So can we have those back, please?
Yeah. There is oil in coffee beans, right? Mm-hmm. Anybody? Any speculation about what that was?
Was that around the time of the Exxon Valdez?
Yeah, I'm not sure what that would be, but
I think when things, if the grind were really powdery and the temperature were hot and they sat in a carafe for a while, I think I've seen those kind of, you know, when you see mud puddles and in the sidewalk and there's a little bit of oil, you get that
sheen.
Sort of rainbow. Yeah. Sheen. I think that speaks to an interesting point that everybody, like if you go to the souffle place and get a souffle at Café Jacqueline, you don't think, when I make souffles, I do this, 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 and this, you know, but everybody has this relationship with coffee that's almost daily. So they become sort of their own experts and harsh critics, and they know what they like and they know what they don't like. So I think that's one of the kind of the privileges and one of the things that distinguishes us from sort of the normal food service business is we're dealing with people that have, you know, strong opinions and habits that have formed sometimes over decades.
And memories, a lot of memories.
And memories, well. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go now to Andrew in Sacramento. Andrew, are you there?
Yeah.
Hi.
Yeah, hi. First thing, my compliments to Blue Bottle Cafe. I watched one of their tutorials on chow tips and made a huge difference.
That's super. Thanks.
Second thing, I like to make my espresso and just add a bit of half and half to it, and it really smooths out the flavor. And I guess my final question is, I use a Pavoni espresso maker, the manual one, and the first time I make an espresso, it always turns out terrible, and then everyone after that is perfect. I was wondering what I could do, to make that first one the best so I didn't have to waste, one grind each time.
Eileen, any thoughts about that?
There are a few things it could be. I mean, one thing I wonder is if there's coffee sitting in the grinder that's maybe not as fresh, assuming you're grinding it fresh. Another is the temperature of the water. I would expect that, you know, maybe running the group without the portafilter in might probably lower the temperature a little bit, which is maybe the effect that you're having on the second and third shots. But and to me, that's just part of the process. When our baristas open the coffee bar, they make a lot of shots and taste them and throw them away before we get something that we're willing to serve a customer.
All right. Thanks for the call. And read some email here. Tram writes, I appreciate coffee snobs, but the problem is they don't appreciate anyone else. Has it occurred to today's guests that others might have different ways of enjoying coffee, and that's okay too? Anybody? I mean, I don't think any of you are saying theirs is the only way.
Yeah, I don't think any of us would disagree with that. I mean, we have our standards for our shops that we've come upon because we really enjoy it that way. And were we to make this sort of infinite range of styles, I don't know how I would do that.
Yeah.
Here's another email. Dave in Alameda writes, Starbucks is largely responsible for migrating America from undrinkable Folgers and Maxwell House, etc., that prevailed for generations. They're the driving force behind the ubiquity of decent coffee. Coffee lovers should love them for that, but instead they seem to badmouth Starbucks as a corporate meanie in favor of Peet's. That's a publicly traded company. Why is that? Anybody have any thoughts about that, Eileen?
I think that's mostly just that Peet's is the hometown brand here.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a lot of loyalty to Peet's. You'll find that in Seattle, there's that same loyalty to Starbucks.
To Starbucks. And was it Seattle's Best? Is that also a brand up there?
Yes. It's a subsidiary of
Subsidiary.
Starbucks.
And even Peet's, there's this whole question of whether it's a chain, you know, and I think it is a chain. I mean, in the sense that it has a lot of outlets. And I know James Blue Bottle is expanding to New York now. What do you think about that? How do you guard against not the image of being a chain, but about the, you know, spreading yourself too thin?
Well, I mean, I feel like, you know, being at the scale we are and we are about to be, you know, we have a 5-person training department now, and we have a green bean buyer that's going to origin countries and buying great coffee for us. So there's a certain luxury at a point where, you know, we can afford things to make our coffee better. I feel like 2012, our coffee is going to be better than in 2011, and certainly 11 was better than 2010. I think, you know, we all kind of think about, well, the point of the inevitable decline, and what is that point, and
how do you guard against it?
And how do you guard against it? But I think there's ways. I mean, I'm just such a little speck compared to a big company like Peet's or Starbucks, even if I doubled in size every year, you know?
Yeah. Another comment here. Somebody writes, I'd love to hear your guests talk about what they're doing to improve supply chain transparency so that those of us who care can determine whether the coffee growers in places like Ethiopia are giving a living wage for producing such great beans to make a cup of coffee that costs $3 a cup.
That's a huge part of what I've been working on. I just did my year-end numbers, and in 2010, 86% of the coffee that I bought was bought direct from coffee farmers. And to me, what that means is we made a substantive visit to the farm, and the farmer, we knew how much the farmer, you know, we made a deal directly with the farmer, and the farmer knew how much it was going to cost us to get the coffee here. Because, of course, though we're meeting with the farmer and making a deal directly with the farmer based on the cup quality, how the coffee tastes, of course, there are so many other people involved. There are exporters, there are importers. You know, you have to get the coffee here, and that's a complicated process, especially if you want to do it in a timely fashion. And then this year, looking at our numbers, it was 95% of our coffee, which is really exciting. The other 5% is Ethiopia and Kenya, which have very different trade structures, where buying direct is a lot more challenging. So I'm excited that my coffee buyer, Steve, the James former barista, was just in Ethiopia and Kenya and is setting up projects where we're going to be working directly with a group of Ethiopian farmers to get some of their coffee in. And it's a situation where we're working with a co-op. We know what the farmers are getting paid. Yeah. They know what we're paying.
And James, Jeremy, are you working also? I assume you are directly with farmers. Mm-hmm. And what's the whole concept of fair trade? I mean, what's the status of that now?
Well, fair trade is a brand name that's owned by a nonprofit called Transfer USA, and
they have Oakland business.
Another Oakland business, yes. And they have their list of criteria, and I think it's relevant, important when you're dealing with commodity levels of coffee. Like if you're in a Walmart and you're wanting to buy coffee, to look for fair trade certified coffee, I think can really be helpful. In shops like ours, we're paying many multiples above the fair trade minimum anyway. So and we tend to be rewarding farmers for higher quality coffee. Mm-hmm. So I feel like the feedback loop that's important for farmers is if they grow better coffee, they're going to make a lot more money. You know, the Cup of Excellence auctions are a great example of that. Sometimes people are getting, you know, 20 times the commodity price, 40 times the commodity price, because they've really delved into their coffee quality.
Mm-hmm. And who's training them to do that?
There's the Cup of Excellence is a nonprofit, and there's a lot of initiatives in different source countries by different NGOs that I think are helping. And then it's just the natural resourcefulness of the farmer who, like, sees a way to support himself even more.
Here's an email from Ina in San Francisco. What are your guest views on caffeine and decaf coffees? As a coffee lover who, for health reasons, has to consume a lot less caffeine, I'm curious about how to have the best coffee decaf experience. Anyone?
I guess that's mostly about the beans.
Yeah.
Is
there anything about the process of, you know, decaffeinating that, you know?
Yeah, it definitely compromises the integrity of the structure of the bean itself in green form when you have it decaffeinated. And we send those up to Swiss water. And I think what's interesting is most decaffeinated beans, especially if you're not buying the coffee directly yourself, sourcing the green yourself, it often comes from brokers, importers who couldn't sell the coffee. And or had too much of it, or was a lower quality than they expected when it came in, and they'll send it off for decaf, and then it'll come back. So it might be 2 years old, it might be damaged. Mm. But what we do is we take a large supply of beans, and we send off half of it for decaf.
Yeah. Anybody else want to add anything to that? No.
I mean, there are some innovations in decaffeination that are making it better. But knowing that it's only a small section of the audience that even drinks decaf, I don't want to spend too much time on it.
Sure. And then a quick, maybe we can get a quick answer here because we're short on time. Nick in Redwood City, the coffee recipes on the Blue Bottle website call for more than double the amount of coffee to water as I found the specialty coffee experts out there. Why is this? But it tastes better.
Yeah. I mean, it's a matter of opinion. What proportion tastes good? I mean, I've been to like places like Oslo, sometimes the brewing ratio is 17 to 1, 17 parts of water to 1 part coffee. You know, I've been to places in Japan where it's like 4 to 1.
Wow.
I like 10 to 1, to 12 to 1, to 14 to 1. Some people like a bigger spread. Some people like a smaller. It's a matter of taste and how you're extracting it and at what temperature.
But if you go into one of your shops, you're going to get a particular ratio. I mean, change from...
Well, it changes for us from varietal to varietal. So we'll work out, like our blends have a certain ratio and then single origin sometimes will be different.
Okay. All right. Well, James Freeman from Blue Bottle Coffee, thanks to you for being here this hour. Thanks also to Eileen Hasse from Ritual Coffee Roasters and Jeremy Tooker also from... Four Barrel Coffee on Valencia Street. And thanks to all of you for your calls and emails as well. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Amy Machado. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer today is Danny Bringer. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again tomorrow.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.